I will call the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee to order and welcome everyone. I want to do, it's not on the agenda, but I want to do just a brief introduction around the table. And then we have some staff over here, too. And just a brief introduction will be great so everybody knows who one another are. And we'll start over here with, I think, the newest member of the legislature that's on this. Well, we have some over here that are brand new on this committee, too. But go ahead.
Good. Hello, everyone. My name is Anam Mahmoud, and I represent 62B, which is South Minneapolis.
Hello. Thank you, Chair. Representative Breon Curran from 36B. I represent White Bear Lake, Vadnais Heights, Gem Lake, Birchwood Village, and half of White Bear Township.
Good morning. Representative Kelly Moeller, 40A, Northern Ramsey County Suburbs.
Lee Finke, she, her pronouns, 66A. I'm from St. Paul.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sandra Feist. I represent 39B, which is parts of New Brighton, Columbia Heights, and St. Anthony.
Madam Chair, Ben Johnson from House Research Department. I'm one of the three House research analysts that staffs this committee. I also do public safety and staffing the Fraud Prevention Committee.
My name's Anna Borgerding, she, her pronouns, and I am the DFL Committee Administrator for Judiciary.
Good morning, everybody. Madam Chair, I'm Tina Liebling from Rochester. I'm going to be the non-voting member for these few weeks, and pleased to be serving on this committee.
Thank you. And Representative Peggy Scott, I represent 31B, which is Northern Anoka County.
Marissa Mantefell, I'm the GOP Committee Administrator.
Liam Edgar, I'm the Committee Legislative Assistant.
John Walls, House Fiscal Staff.
Representative Walter Hudson, 30A, Otsego, St. Michael, Albertville, Hanover, and Rockford Township.
Matt Bliss, Representative 2B, Northern Minnesota.
Representative Bedell Duran, 2A, parts of Beltrami, Lake of the Woods, and Clearwater County.
Representative Marion Rarick, formerly O'Neill, now Rarick. Represents 29B, which is Buffalo, Monticello, Maple Lake, out in Wright County.
All right, Representative Terry Steer, I represent 22B, which is Le Sueur County, a little bit of Scott, Rice, and Blue Earth.
And Representative Ingen is presenting a bill in another committee. Representative Frazier, you want to introduce yourself? Perfect, thank you. And on this table, we have Nathan Hopkins, House Research, and are the other two DFL staff?
Yeah, I'm Zach Meyer, no. DFL Research.
Okay, and?
Nonpartisan, I'm House Public Information Office, so I write for session data.
Okay.
Jim Walker.
Okay, perfect, thank you. And over here we have Miss Davis, and she does family law. What else do you cover? Perfect. And our committee researcher for the GOP is? All right. Thank you. Well, this morning, I don't know that I've ever been in committee where we've heard from the Board of Judicial Standards. Maybe you've been here before and I've just forgotten it over the years. But thank you for being with us today. And real quickly, we'll go through. Were there any questions on the committee rules? They're in your packets. Just a couple things to highlight on that. All handouts must be provided to the committee administrator by noon the day before a scheduled committee hearing. And individuals wishing to testify before the committee should notify the committee administrator by noon the day before. And all substantive amendments must be received by the committee administrator by 4 p.m. the day before. And signs, noise, or demonstrations that disrupt the committee's work may result in removal from the hearing room. Anybody have any questions on those, just kind of highlights of the rules? All right. Now we'll go to the sentencing, or not sentencing guidelines, folks. The presentation by the Board of Judicial Standards. Please introduce yourselves for the tape and go ahead with your presentation.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Basens. With me is Mary Pat Maher. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Board on Judicial Standards, and we are pleased to have the invitation to present to you today. Before I do begin, though, I have a window on my screen that is asking me to start the meeting. Should I do anything about that.
Okay. So, members, I guess we're waiting on somebody from IT to come and figure this whole thing out. But there are copies in your packets of their presentation. Okay, yeah. There we go. Awesome. And please, I know the mics aren't necessarily close to you, so you might have to move them closer so that everybody can hear. That would be great. So go ahead.
All right. So just briefly today, I'll talk a little bit about the history of this board, the board operations, which I think primarily is the main interest of the committee, and some of the ways we go about fulfilling the mission of the agency, which is education and discipline. So before this board came into existence, the only way to discipline a judge was through impeachment, which is the way in Minnesota it was done. It's taken through the federal constitution. It turned out to be a very cumbersome proceeding, very expensive. I think in the history up to 1971, only one judge was ever impeached, and ultimately that was expunged. So in the early 1920s, there was a federal movement to create a code of ethics for judges to follow. That started in 1923 when the ABA enacted a code of conduct. In the early 1970s, maybe late 1960s, states began trying to implement some way to bring this code of conduct to the state courts. So in the early 1970s, the legislature and the Supreme Court also kind of had competing committees, boards trying to handle judicial conduct in Minnesota. In 1972, there was an amendment to the Constitution that allowed the legislature to provide by law for the retirement of all judges for the extension of the term of any judge who becomes eligible for retirement within 3 years. It basically allowed the legislature to enact some statutes to create this board. The legislature did that through Minnesota Statutes 490A and gave the authority to promulgate the judicial code and the rules governing how the board operates to the Supreme Court. So the Minnesota Supreme Court has promulgated the Code of Judicial Conduct. It is largely based on the ABA model code, but with some variations based on how Minnesota operates. And likewise, it enacted rules to govern how the board operates. The preamble to the judicial code sets out the purpose of judicial discipline, and it talks about the main goals, but the judiciary, one thing it does state that I want to highlight is that the judiciary plays a central role in preserving the principles of justice and the rule of law. Inherent in all the rules contained in this code are the precepts that judges individually and collectively must respect and honor the judicial office as a public trust and strive to maintain and enhance confidence in the legal system. So the board takes that seriously and understands its role through discipline and education of judges is vital to adhering to the mission of the preamble. The Minnesota Board has specifically adopted this mission. It's an independent state agency that receives and acts upon complaints that Minnesota judges have engaged in misconduct. The board also handles judicial disability matters. In addition, the board issues advisory opinions and seeks to educate judges and others about judicial ethics. The purpose of the board is to protect the public, promote confidence in the integrity and independence of the judiciary. This board encourages judges to maintain high standards of conduct on and off the bench. The board rules provide for the composition of the board. There are 10 members. There are 4 judges. One is a Court of Appeals judge. The other 3 are district court judges. There are 4 public members and 2 attorney members. I got ahead of myself a little bit. So each term for a member is 4 years with the option of a 4-year extension. The governor appoints the members. All but the judge members are confirmed by the Senate. And we've really had a great diversity in the background of the membership and the location that they're coming from. We try to find, you know, to the extent possible, we try to make sure there's information going out around the state so that we have members that represent the entire state, not just the metro area. Our meetings are held in Minneapolis, but it is important to be able to have members from around the state. So we do have a judge from Duluth right now. There'll be an opening for a judge coming up soon, I think, and we'll hopefully find somebody else from greater Minnesota to fill that position. And I just have a list of the current members for purposes of this meeting. I'll just highlight that Tim O'Brien is the chair. He's an attorney, a retired attorney from Minnesota, or from Minneapolis. The vice chair is Judge Bjorkman from the Court of Appeals. She'll be, her term is expiring, so a new Court of Appeals member will be appointed soon. And the third executive committee member is a public member. Scott Sakaguchi is a retired surgeon. And so for our executive committee, we have a member from each of the roles of the board. Those are the remaining members. So board operations, I'm going to go into how we handle complaints first. We receive complaints from all over the state. We receive complaints from litigants, from lawyers, from other judges, from witnesses, from, you know, people who pick up stories in the media. Just we get them from in Minnesota, and with all the media attention, some cases we get complaints from around the world as well. So you'll see a giant jump in the number of complaints we've received in the last few years. At the end of 2021, we started an online complaint system, and it's really attracted a lot of numerous more complaints are coming in. We review every complaint that comes in, respond to most of them by letter. The repeat complaints, we've started to filter those out a little bit. But we respond to each complainant and let them know whether the board is going to review their case or if it's just going to be summarily dismissed. Complaints that are summarily dismissed are outside the board's jurisdiction generally. Complaining about a judge's decision, that's something generally for the Court of Appeals to review. So this chart shows how complaints come into the office, and you can see primarily people are using that online complaint system. Despite the increase in the number of complaints we're receiving, we haven't seen a noticeable jump in the files opened. So once a complaint is received, we review it. If it's jurisdictional, open a file, bring it to the board for their review, and then the board decides whether to investigate. And I'll get into those details a little bit further down. The primary concern for the board in the complaints that they receive are bias, general demeanor. We do get a lot of demeanor complaints, especially I think with Zoom. And then failure to follow law or procedure. Those are generally filtered out as non-jurisdictional. You can see these numbers add up to more than the 40-some complaints opened last year, because many complaints, as you can imagine, have more than one allegation. This chart shows the sources of complaints. Litigants are the primary complainants. But we do get a lot from attorneys and judges. Chief judges in their administrative duties may raise a concern about a case or the conduct of a judge. And this chart shows of the 45 complaints opened last year, primarily district court judges received the most complaints. This board has a jurisdiction over conciliation court referees, tax court judges, child support magistrates. So there's kind of an other category, and they might fit in there. And you can see in this chart the dispositions per year. I'll go into the different levels of discipline in a few minutes, but this just kind of shows there's, you know, some years there are more or less, but overall it's kind of steady in the number of dispositions issued. So focusing on the complaint process, once we get a complaint, I'll review it. This board also has a part-time staff attorney, so the two of us will review it and decide next step. If it's a summary dismissal, we'll notify the complainant by letter that their complaint has been summarily dismissed with a short explanation of why. If it's possible that a judge has violated the code, then we'll open up a file and bring it to the board at their next meeting for their consideration. The board is able to dismiss those complaints or initiate an investigation. If they initiate an investigation, we generally provide notice to the judge and they're able to respond to the complaint. The staff attorney and I'll review the complaint, the investigation, write up a memo, bring it back to the board. Investigations for a typical complaint would look like talking to some witnesses. If it's something that happened during a hearing, we have access to the transcript and audio recording of the hearing, so we're able to get that evidence. We bring that back to the board. The board considers the complaint and the investigation. On occasion, the board might want the judge who is subject of the complaint to come and speak with the board. And then after reviewing all of that, the board will make its next decision whether to investigate or whether to dismiss the complaint, issue a letter of caution, which is a dismissal, but it does provide the judge with some future guidance regarding their conduct. And so those are the two dismissals. If there's a concern about that the judge violated the code, there are different levels of discipline. The board may enter into a private admonition, a deferred disposition agreement, and a public reprimand are the three primary tools the board is able to use to resolve cases. And for those three, the judge has to agree to enter into the disciplinary, you know, agree to the admonition or not contest it. If they do contest it, then there could be a hearing before a three-member panel. Before I get too far into that hearing, if the board is concerned that the conduct is very serious and warrants a sanction more serious than a public reprimand, the board is also able to file a formal complaint. So if the judge contests whatever is offered in terms of resolving the case, or if the conduct is so serious that the board feels it warrants a suspension, a censure, something like that, then it'll file the formal complaint. The Supreme Court appoints a hearing panel. The hearing panel is comprised of a judge, often it would be a retired judge, a public member who often has some sort of experience in ethics and maybe was a previous board member, and a lawyer member. So the board will hold a hearing before this panel. Witnesses may be called. It's really quite a lot like an evidentiary hearing or a trial. And then the panel will make findings and a recommendation as to the disposition. Once they make the findings and recommendation, either the board or the judge is able to appeal that to the Supreme Court. And then the Supreme Court ultimately will make its decision. So on to education. The board is able to provide opinions to judges. We do that through informal advisory opinions where a judge may write a question about future conduct that they'd like to engage in. It might be something about fundraising or do I have a conflict of interest where I need to disqualify from a case. So I'm able to answer those. I generally answer informal requests for advice by email so that it's documented for the judge and for the board. The board also issues formal advisory opinions. We just issued one. It's up on our website for public comment. And we just issued a one on disqualification. So we're really seeking to educate judges, to avoid the disciplinary process if possible, but also to preserve the integrity of the judiciary, preserve public confidence in the judiciary. And I'm always really happy to provide advisory opinions to judges. The last few years, we've probably issued about 150 informal advisory opinions every year. So judges are using this resource, and we're happy to provide it. So these are just some examples of questions judges have asked. They do have more restrictions than the average citizens on their political activity. The Constitution requires that they live within their district. So every once in a while, you know, if a judge has had a fire and needs to move outside of the district for a week or two while there's a home repair, they might ask a question and make sure it's okay to, you know, live outside district for 2 weeks, something like that. So we get a lot of questions about disqualification. We get a lot of questions because judges are members of the community and they want to serve on nonprofits or they want to be involved in youth sports, things like that. So we do get a lot of questions about their community involvement as well. So jumping back to discipline, in 2024, the board was a little bit more active in issuing discipline. We primarily act on complaints that the board receives. It's not necessarily out there looking for complaints, but it was a little bit more of an active year. So there's one formal complaint that was issued, and that matter is still pending before the Supreme Court. Three public reprimands. Those were all reprimands that judges agreed to accept. Two deferred disposition agreements and 8 letters of caution. So that's it for my presentation. I think the committee was a little bit interested in budget, and so Mary Pat has a few comments to make about the budget request.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Mary Pat Maher, and I'm the executive assistant for the board. The governor is recommending that the board receive a $10,000 increase in 2026 and a $21,000 increase each subsequent year. These increases would fund the board's operating cost increases and help us establish a retirement and resignation fund. In the next biennium, we are anticipating increases in our employer-paid health care contributions, rent increases, and staff salary increases. And we currently don't have any money in our budget for retirement severance payouts or resignation payouts. And so we'd like to establish a fund for that purpose.
And thank you. And could you tell the committee what the current budget of the board is? What's your base budget?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, our current base budget is $520,000 a year, and we also receive a separate appropriation of $125,000 each fiscal year. That's designated for our major investigations and hearings.
Thank you.
The $520,000 is for our operating funds.
And what, to the testifier, does each board member receive like a stipend every time they meet? How does that work? How does, like, the 520, I'm assuming it pays for some salaries here, but beyond that, could you explain how your budget works?
Sure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, board members do receive a per diem for attending board meetings and other meetings. The district court judges do not receive that because they're not allowed to, but the other members of the board do receive a $55 per diem for attendance at board meetings.
Okay, thank you. Are there member questions for the board? Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really quickly on the last slide, you talked about you had three public reprimands. Where are those posted so that members of the public can see that? It seems to be an odd question I get an awful lot in my position.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Rarick, the board maintains a website, and it posts all of its public discipline in its full form on the website. We also provide education through summarizing most of the private admonitions, some of the letters of caution. So if you just go to the website, there's a link for discipline and then separate links for Supreme Court discipline, public reprimands. And I think all of the reprimands since 2009 are on that site. And then also the private disciplinary summaries.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Bedell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are the investigation outcomes, is that all public?
To the testifier.
Madam Chair, Representative Duran, no. If there's a deferred disposition agreement or a private admonition, a dismissal, a letter of caution, those remain private, at least on the board's end. The board isn't able to provide information publicly about those.
Representative Duran.
Thank you. Why is that?
To the testifier.
So I took some notes on this, excuse me. Madam Chair, Representative Duran, the most states, I understand, have some level of private discipline for judicial officers. The board's rules provide for deferred dispositions, agreements, and private admonitions where conduct is isolated and not serious, and the board is also able to take into consideration mitigating circumstances in determining its level of discipline. So I guess the ideas about it is that it helps maintain public confidence in the judiciary by handling minor issues privately. It can help maintain public trust in the judiciary by avoiding unnecessary publicity surrounding a judge for a minor transgression. And it can help a judge address minor issues early on to avoid repeats and those types of that type of conduct and before it escalates. So it's a bit of an intervention for the judge, the board hopes. But we still do want to provide that educational public or educational value to the public and to other judges, and that is one of the reasons that the board will summarize some of the deferred disposition agreements, private admonitions, and letters of caution. Even though I lumped the letters of caution in there, they are dismissals, not discipline.
Representative Duran.
If the complainant actually wanted a copy of this information, can they receive this information, or is it still private?
The board rules.
Motions.
I apologize.
It's all right.
Madam Chair, Representative Duran, the board rules do not provide for that information to be shared to the complainant.
Representative Duran, follow up?
Not on that, but I do have another question if someone else wants to go.
Let's just go ahead if you have another question, and then we'll go to the next person on the list.
So if the judge, this is say on any one of these disciplinary actions that the board sees, if they don't follow these, what's the ramifications of that? What's the?
Sure.
Motions.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, Representative Duran. If a judge continues to engage in misconduct after being disciplined, every case is handled on a case-by-case basis, but what I have seen in some cases is kind of a progressive discipline. So if a judge continues to violate the same code or the same rule and engages in the same or similar misconduct, then the next step might be more serious discipline down the road. But every case is handled on its own facts, so it's hard to say for sure.
Representative Duran.
So there's no real, discipline for these judges then, because if they just tell you not, or they just completely ignore it, well, I guess what is the ramifications for them just to completely ignore everything? Because they are elected officials, so we're just trying to figure out, like, what actually holds these judges accountable if they're being disciplined at this point in time.
Ms. Boshens.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Duran, each case is handled differently. I have seen that judges are responsive to the idea of progressive discipline. If there is a private admonition, public reprimand, deferred disposition agreement, oftentimes there are conditions attached to that where the judge might need to seek some sort of counseling, an executive coach, additional education. Sometimes there's concern about whether they need some sort of evaluation or therapy, and they might seek that out as part of the agreement with the board.
Okay, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Thank you for being here today. I'm just curious if you have some, do you collect data, for example, around, I'm looking at your list of the sources of complaints. The complaints that you receive that end up becoming investigations, that end up becoming disciplinary actions, do you know who those are most likely to come from? Are they more like the lawyers who are doing that, more likely to have their cases pursued than, say, a citizen or a victim or a litigant? That's my first question.
Ms. Boshens.
Madam Chair, Representative Finke, I don't think we have data specifically on that point, comparing who submitted the complaint versus, you know, comparing it to which files are opened.
Representative Finke, sorry.
No problem. Thank you. Thank you. When you had the public or the internet, you know, online option for issuing complaints, did you see a change in type of complaint, or was it mostly just an increase of the stuff you were hearing previously? And then as a follow-up to that, like, how many of the complaints are pure, like, nuisance complaints?
Ms. Boshens.
Madam Chair, Representative Finke, I'm going to answer the second question first. Nuisance complaints, it's a great number. I don't know the number offhand, but it is quite a few. Probably more than half, I would say. Mm-hmm. And has there been a change in the type of complaints? I don't think so. And I answer it that way because we haven't opened a great number more files, even though the number of complaints have increased.
Representative Fiki?
Thank you. And then I guess I'd just maybe a little more philosophical. Like, what do you foresee here in the next couple of years in terms of judicial review? I mean, I feel like we're kind of headed into a little bit of off-the-map territory around our judges and responding to them. And, you know, not to get too outside of our purview, but it just feels to me like things are changing around the judicial systems in this country. And I would just appreciate kind of like your thoughts about what you are doing right now and where it's kind of moving forward.
Ms. Boshens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Finke, I've been with the board for about 10 years, first in the staff attorney position and for the last year as the executive secretary. And I do think the types of complaints have changed in some way, or at least of the files that have opened. And some of that might be a reflection of the change with Zoom court. That didn't exist 10 years ago, to the extent it does now, at least. And, you know, this last year was definitely busier for the board. I hope that's not the new normal. But to that end, the board is really focused on education and providing education to the bench. We go to bench meetings. I've gone to, you know, four or five of the districts within the last year. I meet individually with judges. I, you know, go to the state court conferences when it works out for the agenda. And so hopefully by, you know, really educating judges of their role and I would love to avoid of what may be to come, but I don't know if that answers your question well enough.
Dr. Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. Obviously, the rule of law is incredibly important, and part of the rule of law is having public trust in the judiciary, as you've discussed. And part of that public trust is what we all do, but part of that public trust, obviously, is how the judges comport themselves in court. And so when I look at some of what the board does here, your slide on the source of complaints, where it shows that not that many of them come from attorneys. And attorneys, of course, are in the best position often to really judge the whether a judge has judicial demeanor, whether they're fair to litigants, whether they, you know, how they comport themselves. That is most often going to be viewed closely by attorneys, and yet attorneys, it seems, don't really make that many complaints. And I wonder whether you've talked about the keeping some of the complaints private and letting judges get some admonition that's private, and I support that. But I also wonder, does the judge get to know who's complaining against them? And the reason I raise that, of course, is because with attorneys, you know, there are many situations where attorneys practice in front of a judge all the time, say. Mm-hmm. And I think it can be very difficult to complain against someone who is going to be hearing your next case. And I wonder how the board views that. So I guess the question is, does the judge get to know who's making the complaint? And what are your thoughts about that concern that maybe you're not hearing complaints you should hear, because attorneys have a lot to lose and probably not a lot to gain by making a report?
Ms. Boshens.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, that's a really great question. It's something we grapple with. So I would note that a lot of litigants do complain about or submit complaints about judges, and I think that there is a great number of self-represented litigants in the courtrooms. And so I do see attorneys. They have a huge role in the courtroom, and they do have an obligation to report misconduct when they do see it. That being said, I wonder sometimes if those complaints are coming through the chief judges. If there's demeanor issues, there might be a conversation with the chief judge, who is then in a position also to file a complaint. And the board is aware, very aware, that it is difficult to provide information to this board that may affect your career and your reputation as an attorney. It does have a provision in its rules that it can withhold the source of the complaint. I think it's for good cause, but generally judges are made aware of who submitted the complaint because they need to have an opportunity to respond. And sometimes withholding the source of the complaint wouldn't even be useful because the facts are so specific that the judge would just know who is complaining about them.
Representative Liebling?
That's all. Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Liebling took one of my questions because I was talking to Representative Mueller about a victim's bill and what a victim advocate can share, because the fear is if that information is able to be shared, then it's going to prevent people from coming forward. And I see this as very similar situation. And if we really want to have that public trust, which is one of the part of your mission statement or what you stand for, it seems to me that that information, to the extent possible, should be kept private from the judge. And it's a concern for me. Next on the list is Representative Steer.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here today. So does anything in Chapter 13 cover the information or prohibit you from giving out the information on judge discipline?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Steer. Chapter 13 doesn't apply to this board. I think it's 13.90. The Supreme Court rules provide for how data is handled and confidentiality of data for the board. I think it's Rule 5 that primarily deals with it.
Representative Steer? I had a couple of questions. Thank you for being here. Is there an appeals process at all in this if a citizen particularly doesn't think, or even an attorney doesn't think that, you know, justice is served for in their case? Is there any appeals process?
Madam Chair, yes, there is an informal appeals process. It's not written out in the rules, but how we handle it is, well, I guess I should say part of it's written out in the rules. If a summary dismissal goes out and somebody is unhappy with that, all of the summary dismissals are reviewed by a board member. So we encourage people, if they are unhappy with a summary dismissal, to write again, explain more about their complaint, and that is again reviewed. After the board takes disciplinary action, you know, they, if there is feedback that is sent by feedback about the decision, they generally do receive information about that. In terms of appealing, I don't think there's a formal mechanism, though, to appeal after disciplinary action has been taken.
Okay. A question about when someone makes a complaint and the flow chart that you had in here. So when someone makes a complaint, it goes to you first, and you decide if it goes to the full board. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct. The staff attorney and I review it, and then we decide if it goes to the full board. If it doesn't, it's summarily dismissed, and at least one board member still reviews it.
And I apologize. I don't have a copy of this, but a member of the public reached out to me this morning and said that their complaint only went to one board member, that the full board didn't have access to their complaint, and they got a letter back saying that this board member reviewed it and didn't find merit in moving forward. Is that a common practice for just one board member to have that authority?
Madam Chair, yes, it is. So the summary dismissals, those are the complaints that are outside the board's jurisdiction generally. And so that is where we have one board member review it. With receiving 900 some complaints a year, it's not tenable for the full board to review every single complaint, especially when they're outside of the board's jurisdiction.
Thank you for that. Do you think in earning the public's trust that at least when, and I understand you dismiss the majority of these cases, I get that, but do you think in the best interest of the public that any disciplinary action, including these letters of caution, should be made public on your website so that, I mean, these are elected officials. It's very difficult to find out information that's compiled all in one place because there really isn't a repository for that. Information on judges that they're voting for, that they have, a citizen's responsibility to cast the vote for who they think is going to do their job the best in the situation. Don't you think having those reprimands of any kind public would be helpful to earn the public trust?
Madam Chair, in some cases, perhaps, but it's really a question for the Supreme Court, who promulgates the rules. And I do see value in providing educational opportunities in these letters of caution, which are dismissals, or for non-serious and isolated incidents, providing educational opportunities and a way for a judge to remedy the situation going forward. There is some value to that.
Thank you. On the, the executive, on the complaint process, the executive secretary gets the complaint. It can go for dismissal, or there's a confidential inquiry and preliminary evaluation. When is the judge, is there a is it in your rules of when the judge is notified that they're being looked at, or do you set up the confidential inquiry prior to the judge being notified? Ms. Boshans, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The rules do provide that the judge is notified if the board votes to investigate. So during the confidential evaluation, that the judge generally is not aware of it, at least from the board's end. And the confidential evaluation generally is looking at court records, perhaps talking to an attorney who may have been present at the hearing or trial, whatever it may be, and just gathering a little bit more information to help the board members understand more of the context of the complaint.
Okay.
That being said, judges are always able to request a copy of their file, so they're able, or any files, so any complaints that have come to the board within the last 4 years, I say 4 years because that's our expungement cycle, if they want to find out if anybody has complained or if a specific person has complained, they may request that information from the board. In that system, you know, I haven't heard any complaints from judges that they wanted to know more about the evaluation. They know that if they can request that information if they want it.
Okay, thanks. And this was your board was established in what, the 70s, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And have there been any changes to the makeup of the board or the statutes surrounding what the board does since that time?
Madam Chair, I do believe there's been slight changes to the makeup of the board and having like a kind of a member on reserve in case there are recusals, but I am not aware of any changes to the makeup of the board since I've been with it for the last 10 years, and I think it would have been early 80s, I think, that things were changed. Sorry, I don't have more
information
about it.
That's all right. I'm wondering if someone, if House Research, if anyone in House Reach might research might have an answer to that question. Mr. Johnson? Yep, for sure. He's going to look it up. Very good. Any other member questions? Oh, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is there any formal process by which judges get feedback on a regular basis on their performance? I mean, you know, we all need it, right? And I think, I mean, let's just acknowledge judges have, especially I think trial judges, have a very difficult job. And, but I've known some good ones who've asked for feedback. But is there any sort of process by which, you know, you talk about the educational function of what you do. Is there a way for judges to get that they do get it before somebody makes complaint?
Ms. Boshans.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I do believe the judicial branch does do some sort of review, but I don't have specific information. This board does not have any sort of specific review set up. If a judge is within a deferred disposition agreement or a private public admonition reprimand with conditions, we do some monitoring through those. But every case is different in how it is handled.
It's a really good question. It's like, do they have a little public survey that they send out after a case, right? For everybody that was involved with the case to fill out. And I don't know if there's, I don't see anybody here from the courts to answer that question, but any of you attorney folks, you ever fill out anything like that after you've been in trial? No? Yeah, everybody's shaking their head no. And there we go. All right. Mr. Johnson, were you successful?
Madam Chair, there's not much history on this statute. It looks like it started in session law in 1971 when this was initially passed, and it stayed in session law for a long time and was actually codified in 2006. I haven't had time to pull up the specific 1971 session law and see if there were changes, but it doesn't look like there were significant changes, and it has not been amended since 2006.
Thank you very much for that. Thank you so much for being here today. It was very informative, and have a wonderful day, the rest of the day. And with that, we'll ask the folks from, we got to get geared up here for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. I know Commissioner Lucero was going to join us virtually. I don't know if that's still happening. She is expecting a child any moment, so she is home. So we could really be history making here if things start happening. As Representative Liebling said, what some people will do to get out of coming to committee, so. All right, we should be good. I think we have Mr. Nico Bauer and perhaps the Commissioner Lucero. Are you there? I can't read what that says. Somebody will have to unmute.
Hi, good morning.
Oh, good morning.
We are here. Are you able to hear us? I don't think we can hear you.
We can hear you. You can't hear us?
Yes. There it goes.
Okay, perfect. The wonders of technology.
Yeah.
Well, how are you feeling?
Me and my family, we're doing really well, and I just would love to start by thanking you for accommodating my family as we are getting ready to welcome this baby.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it from all of you.
Yeah, well, congratulations. Hope everything goes well. Go ahead, introduce yourself, Commissioner, and go ahead with your slideshow.
Thank you so much, Chair Scott. Okay, so good morning, everyone. My name is Rebecca Lucero, and I am the Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. It's wonderful to be here with you today. Also joining me on the line, I have Nico Bauer, he's Government Relations Director. Please feel free to reach out to both of us at any time if you have any questions. We are here to help with anything. So let's talk about the agenda that we are going to work on today. Next slide, please. Great. So super easy. We have three things that we'd like to focus on. First, Minnesota's long history of preventing discrimination. Bottom line, every Minnesotan is protected by and benefits from civil rights laws. We'll go over that a little bit. Second, of course, an agency overview, especially for those who are new to this committee. It's great to meet with you today. And then, of course, finally, we'll discuss Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's 2025 budget proposal. So let's start by talking about Minnesota human rights laws. And you know, when I talk about these, I often ask, when you think about Minnesota and when it started passing civil rights laws, when do you think that was? And oftentimes folks understandably refer to the 1960s. They'll talk about the Civil Rights Act at the federal level. I'm sorry, if you could go back a slide. They'll talk about the 1960s at the civil rights level, and if they are particularly adept, maybe they'll even know when the Minnesota Human Rights Act is. I had one adorable six-year-old explain to me who Ruby Bridges is and why she is so important to the history of the United States. And it was awesome to be able to explain that that Minnesota legislators actually have a long history of preventing discrimination in Minnesota that long predates Ms. Ruby Bridges. And so if you move on to the next slide, you'll see here that, in fact, in Minnesota, legislators first demonstrated their commitment to civil rights when the Minnesota Constitution was ratified. That was on May 11th of 1858, and they did so by prohibiting the practice of slavery in Minnesota. So just for some context here, this was nearly a decade before the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was passed and ratified in 1865. A few more that I'll highlight here. Let's see. In 1921, following the brutal beatings and lynching of three black men in Duluth by a mob in Duluth, Minnesota legislators actually passed a 1921 anti-lynching law. This was 100 years before an anti-lynching law was passed at the federal level. That law has changed and morphed over time, but again, that strong commitment by Minnesota legislators through the years. One that I will highlight, if you want to move to the next slide, a little bit more, is the 1885 Equal Accommodation Act, which was signed in Minnesota 140 years ago. And what it said, hey, businesses that are open to the public, think about hotels, restaurants, theaters, these places are prohibited from preventing Black Minnesotans from having access to these establishments. This actually passed a couple years after Frederick Douglass was in Minnesota. And when he was in Minnesota, he was prevented from staying in, I think, one or two hotels in St. Paul. And so this law prevented that kind of discrimination being in place. And these laws are what are called public accommodation laws. And while Minnesota legislators first passed this law in 1885, it obviously and of course lives on today in the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And in the Minnesota Human Rights Act, it says that discrimination by public businesses like hotels, theaters, coffee shops, trains, these places cannot deny someone access to these spaces because of someone's race, color, ethnicity, religion, sex, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, age, national origin, or disability. Harassment, discrimination, and retaliation for those are prohibited because of this longstanding public accommodation law that's been in place in Minnesota. If you go to the next slide, you'll see here a picture of when the Department of Human Rights itself was officially formed, and that was in 1967 when Governor Harold Lavander, pictured here, signed the Minnesota Human Rights Act into law. I think one of the things that I'll just flag or note here is that the vast majority of these, just these handful of historical pieces that I've highlighted here, almost all of them were passed with either bipartisan support or as an example here of this, of the passing of the Minnesota Human Rights Act, this was actually passed with during a trifecta where the Republican Party had control of all three branches, the House, Senate, and the governorship at the time. So it's something that's deeply supported across the board by Minnesota. And over the years, state legislators have made changes to the Minnesota Human Rights Act. So just a few that I'll just highlight here. In 1973, discrimination in employment, housing, and education is now prohibited on the basis of marital status, disability status, or status with regards to public assistance. And a decade later, reasonable accommodation laws were put into place. Importantly, this was long before the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act at the federal level, passed these same requirements around reasonable accommodations. In 1993, Minnesota became the first state to prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. And beginning last August in 2024, Minnesotans with intermittent health conditions, things like diabetes or epilepsy, maybe someone who has cancer in remission, now have protections from disability discrimination under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. So there's countless more examples that I could share with you, but my message here is that Minnesotans have a strong anti-discrimination laws in place, which every Minnesotan benefits from today. And there are two main areas that we do this work. The first is to investigate, mediate, conciliate, litigate, and monitor discrimination cases. And the second is to work with businesses who are required to have a workforce and, if applicable, equal pay certificate. This is if they are contracting with a state, city, county, University of Minnesota. Let's actually start in that second area there, the workforce certificates. So if you go on to the next slide here. So the legislature has required that businesses have a workforce certificate and an equal pay certificate before starting significant projects with state agencies or cities, counties. This actually first started in the 1980s when legislators said, hey, if we're going to be investing heavily in the state, and we are, bridges and roads, stadiums, let's make sure that these jobs are really available to everyone and so that there cannot be any decisions made on who does not receive these contracts or those jobs because of, for instance, race and sex. In 2014, under the Women's Economic Security Act, MDHR was then mandated by statute to support businesses around equal pay certificates to ensure that men and women are paid equally for the same job. So let me give you a specific example of something I was actually just reviewing last week regarding a company that has an equal pay certificate with the state. The staff at MDHR were working with that company to review different pieces of their work. Particularly, they looked at job classifications, and they wanted to make sure that employees were correctly classified. And as a result of this analysis, the company identified for MDHR several employees that they had found, all of them who were women, who had been paid less than men for the exact same job. With the help of MDHR, each of those working in the same job are paid the same rate and same ranges for that for those job classifications now. So that has been a change to those employees who are getting paid less than. Additionally, with the help of MDHR and, of course, in compliance with law, this company updated several processes from informing their current staff about job openings to better processes in assessing their employees' performance. At the end of the day, my goal is to always prevent discrimination from happening before it happens. So knowing that all these women are now being paid fairly is a great outcome. And even more important is the work the company has done to prevent any future discriminatory outcomes from happening in the coming future here. And we are always thoughtful about how we can be good partners with vendors or businesses. And so next I want to talk about the work that we've done. Some of you have heard me talk about it before with our contractor portal and provide a little bit of updates on it. This is something that would be a longer, I could talk about in a lot more detail if it would be helpful to meet offline to talk about this. But we have been working to create a workforce and equal pay certificate portal. It converts the forms that vendors have to complete as part of their applications into online forms that make it substantially easier for them to complete these forms. So working to improve the experience for 3,500 businesses or vendors across the state, streamlining the process, and that's improving efficiencies for everyone involved. That includes, you know, the staff at MDHR, certainly the contractors, and other state agencies or cities and counties who are responsible to have workforce and equal pay certificates as part of their procurement process. This is deeply aligned with our goal of supporting businesses, again, to prevent discrimination from happening in the first place. We are on track to launch this portal this year and are already building the systems for testing this summer. So we're hoping that it is finalized and up at the end of the year. We are on track to make that happen. So stay tuned for more work there. Let me switch to talking about our investigations. So broadly, this is what MDHR is most often known for. And what you are seeing here is a slide that shows the main areas that are covered in the Minnesota Human Rights Act. So for instance, what this slide is showing is that in employment, a decision around hiring, firing, or disciplining cannot be made because of, for instance, my race. I can be hired, fired, or promoted for all sorts of reasons, but it cannot be for an unlawful reason. And making such a decision because of any of these reasons could be a violation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And similarly, if someone, you know, walks into a coffee shop and the person behind the counter, so this is a business open to the public here, does not want to serve them because maybe they are pregnant, that could be a violation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The statute covers additional places as well, such as government services and credit, all detailed in statute. But as you can see, as we move through these slides, these areas here, these four areas here, unlawful discrimination in employment, housing, businesses open to the public, and schools, these are the areas where Minnesotans reach out the most about potential violations, and so that's why I'm flagging them here. If we move on to the next slide, we can look at our investigations writ large. So first and foremost, it's important to note that our cases come from Minnesotans directly. And they come from all over Minnesota. I believe all but just a couple of counties are where we have cases in since I have been commissioner. Minnesotans can only file cases allowed by statute, by 363A. So we get asked questions if we can look at something outside of our jurisdiction. We cannot. It is statutorily regulated. Why Minnesotans reach out? They reach out because they believe that they were unlawfully discriminated against, harassed, or retaliated against. And we at the agency have an investigation team that supports Minnesotans by conducting a neutral fact-finding investigation. We also offer mediation services that I'll talk about here in a second. When that neutral fact-finding investigation is complete, we issue a finding under Minnesota Statute 363A. What this slide shows here is where Minnesotans are filing cases with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights on what topics. And so as I previewed for you a second ago, these are the top areas. And employment makes up about half of our cases that we are seeing right now. This, of course, makes sense since this is where Minnesotans spend a lot of their time at work. Schools, housing, and businesses open to the public are other main areas of coverage. You should also know that Minnesotans most commonly report discrimination on the basis of three areas: disability, sex, and race. Some months, one of these will be higher than the other, but pretty consistently throughout my time, these have been the three areas that we see the most cases. Let's talk a little bit about process. I think that's always a little helpful, and I can always go into detail on this more offline if it would be helpful. But if anyone in your district believes they were discriminated against, they should contact our department to speak with a neutral investigator to determine if what they experienced falls under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. So this is the first page that they would go to start completing information. On this next page here, you see the process. And what's important to note here is that this process incorporates the legal and procedural safeguards required by law to ensure fairness and due process. Obviously, this is a high level overview of it, but what you, I hope, can see here is that parties who are named in a case have notice and all parties have an opportunity to present this case. It means that decisions made by MDHR are supported after an investigation and made by clear legal reasoning based on the appropriate legal standards of proof. And it means that parties have an opportunity by law to appeal this decision. And of course, we are all also highly regulated by the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, which is a really important part of this process. Talking about mediation, which is something that I mentioned, I really love to talk about our mediation program. It's something that we've been really intentional about developing. And that's because in mediation, both parties meet with a trained mediator to talk through possible ways to resolve their case. So this is a neutral space and parties can mutually communicate, and ideally they're hearing each other and they're reaching an agreement that really works for everyone. Importantly, this saves time, money, and resources for really all involved. So if it works, it can be a great process, and it has been very successful. We have a really high success rate when it comes to cases that go through our mediation program because of the intentionality of the work that we do to move into that. If we do not mediate the case, but we do in fact investigate it, there are a lot of cases that we do conclude. And so on this next slide, you'll see some of the sexual harassment and assault cases our department has recently settled. What we find, of course, is that sexual harassment and assault is pervasive and persistent. It occurs in workplaces, it occurs in schools, it occurs in every county in Minnesota. At the top of this list here, you'll see a McDonald's case. Here we found a 24-year-old manager was using his position of power to repeatedly sexually assault a 14-year-old employee at the restaurant. After completing that neutral investigation and issuing that determination, we reached a consent decree with the McDonald's franchisees. And our focus was really making sure that there could be systems changes to make sure that its workers can go to work without being sexually harassed or assaulted again. This case, as you can, or as I mentioned, involves a minor. So it was a 14-year-old employee at the restaurant, sexually assaulted by their manager. And so there are supposed to be, and now are, procedures and policies in place around where and when a minor can work, who they can work around, and also how they can call to report potential concerns around sexual harassment or discrimination. None of those policies were either in place or were being appropriately followed. So again, our goal is to prevent discrimination from happening further moving forward, recognizing that it happened here. Other examples that we can highlight, of course, are in the education space. Children deserve the opportunity to thrive socially and academically in school. And our goal here is, again, to proactively prevent and stop harassment and discrimination cases. So when we do look and work on a case, for instance, the Pine City Public Schools case, which was one that we just announced a few months ago, we work to make sure that we can support school districts to take action to prevent and address harassment and avoid violations of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. So that case, the Pine City Public Schools case, was a seventh grader, so a really young kid who was repeatedly harassed, bullied for months by nearly a dozen students because of her race. There was no meaningful engagement to put a stop to it, and this young kid, seventh grader, was greatly impacted and missed several weeks of school. So we want students and school teachers and schools to be successful. We believe all of them want that as well, which is why when we announced the case, we provided all of those action steps that schools can take to support their teachers and their students to create an environment that is free from discrimination in alignment with the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Minnesotans also have a right to request reasonable accommodations as allowed under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. So the first place that you will see this is one of the places that we highlight as the most common type of cases we see, and that's with disability accommodations. Under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, employers are obligated to provide a reasonable accommodation for employers and job applicants who request one, so long as doing so does not impose an undue hardship on their employee. We really encourage employers to really think creatively to provide accommodations to make their spaces accessible for everyone. Today, for instance, you have accommodated me and my family, and I'm very grateful for that, and I hope that it has not created any hardship that we can't otherwise solve. Another area that we see these reasonable accommodations is in religious accommodations. Now, here the law, again, requires employers to reasonably accommodate an employee's religious beliefs or practices unless doing so would cause more than a minimal burden on the operations of the employee's business. Here again, we really encourage employers to proactively make adjustments to their environment that creates an inclusive workspace to allow people to practice their religion and create accommodations where it is possible to do so by law. A recent case exemplifying this obligation is a case where a charging party contacted the Department of Human Rights. She was requesting a religious accommodation from her employer. As a Christian woman, she was looking for some accommodations that were in alignment with her religious beliefs. In this situation, the respondent or the employer did not provide a reasonable accommodation, didn't even really engage in an interactive process to try to figure one out or an explanation for refusal, and terminated the charging party's employment. So not what we want to see from employers, especially when we see how they treat similarly situated people different, which is something that we did find in our investigation. For those reasons, we arrived at a probable cause determination of discrimination. And this is an example of reasonable accommodation cases. The last ones that I'll highlight are pregnancy discrimination. So if you go to the next slide, you know, the pregnancy discrimination has been illegal in Minnesota since 1977, so for a very long time. It can include an employer denying a temporary reasonable accommodation to a pregnant employee, or an employer firing or denying a promotion to an employee based on the employee's pregnancy. We have several of these cases, many of which we've announced, where people were told by their employer, why don't you go ahead and come back after you're done giving birth so we don't have to kind of deal with this right now. Really heartbreaking cases for families who oftentimes will lose their health insurance right when a mom is giving birth and needs that health insurance the most. So we want to make sure that the thousands of babies that are born in the coming years in Minnesota, that their families are protected, can't be fired for it. I think the last case that I'll just flag for you here is, of course, the consent decree with the City of Minneapolis and the Minneapolis Police Department. This case will be a case that we are working on for many years to come. This consent decree follows a comprehensive investigation into the policies and procedures of the Minnesota Police Department and the City of Minneapolis. And our investigation found that the city engages in a pattern or practice of race-based policing. As part of our investigation and as part of the negotiations for the consent decree, we really spent a lot of time meeting directly with police officers and community members to understand what would be most important towards achieving transformational changes around race-based policing. Many of those provisions are included that police officers asked for and community members asked for are included directly into that consent decree. And I imagine that many of you are tracking the consent decree with the City of Minneapolis and the U.S. Department of Justice that was reached in January. There, and I get asked a lot of questions about what is the status or how does that impact the Department of Human Rights. And so just a little bit of context, since filing the consent decree, the Department of Justice has since ordered an immediate halt on all of this similar civil rights work, and they are determining and evaluating how they plan to move forward. At this place, we don't know how or if they will move forward. But regardless of how the DOJ proceeds, the work outlined under the Minnesota Department of Human Rights and the Minnesota Human Rights Act continues, because that consent decree is in place. When we opened the case originally after the murder of George Floyd in 2020, we did so knowing at that time the Department of Justice would not open an investigation at that moment. So our work started and continues with or without the Department of Justice. Importantly, it can only be terminated by the court when the city and MPD have reached full, effective, and sustained compliance with the terms of their agreement. At the end of the day, as always, we want law enforcement to be safe, successful, and so trying to prevent discrimination from happening in the first place, making sure that everyone, officers and community members, all go home safely. That case is something that I could also provide a much longer briefing on if it would be helpful in the future. So let's move on to talk about Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's 2025 budget. Let me just start by sharing a few items. MDHR is a people-powered agency, so the vast majority of our budget goes towards staff compensations. That's about 72% of our budget. The rest goes to cover things such as IT, IT costs, and that makes sense that we are a people-powered agent and the staffing compensation given some of the work that we just highlighted. You can see all that playing out. By and large, MDHR's funding comes from the general fund, so that's something else to note. When it comes to our budget request itself, there are three pieces that I want to highlight for you today. First, MDHR has only one budget request. This is the essential budget request that's needed to complete the statutorily required work. Second, this is a modest increase. This is a 2.5% increase for operating adjustments of our projected budget, and it supports rising IT and healthcare costs. And I think, you know, just the third thing that I'll just note, because this is a people-powered agency, this budget request supports the staff and the work they do on behalf of Minnesotans every day. I would be remiss if I didn't take a quick moment to stress how dedicated and hardworking the employees of this agency are for Minnesotans and the deep gratitude that I know we all have for public servants doing their work every single day. So that is our one budget request to highlight. And so I think then we can move on to take any questions. And I really thank you for your time.
Thank you, Commissioner, for your presentation. And do we have any member questions for the Commissioner? Representative Bliss.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I know you covered it right when I was doing my calculations. $17 million with 30 FTEs and the modest increase of another $400,000. It's roughly $600,000 per employee. What, and then you mentioned that it covers IT costs, and that's kind of, I've seen a trend in that with other budgets. What is your IT costs for this budget, just out of curiosity?
Commissioner Lucero.
Chair Scott, Representative Bliss, thank you so much for your question. I think first off, I would like to clarify those FTE numbers. Those FTE numbers that you have there are incorrect. I think that the number is, I'm trying to look through my notes here, but I think it's closer to 60. And so 30 employees is not what, I'm not sure where that's coming from. So let me clarify that. Second, our IT costs have increased and continue to increase for a variety of reasons. I'm pulling up different numbers for you here. And maybe what I could do is follow up with some specifics for you. I just want to note that I lost all camera, so I'm hoping you can see and hear me.
We can see and hear you, Commissioner. Okay. We can see and hear you.
Perfect. I lost being able to see you folks. One of the things that I'll just highlight, though, is some of the investments that we've made, for instance, in the portal for the workforce and equal pay contracts. That, for instance, is making Minnesota and making everything better for Minnesota businesses. And that is an investment that we put some IT work into. And then all of these systems have ongoing costs to keep them updated, to keep privacy and data concerns into place. And so let me get you specific numbers on IT costs following up from here, but that's just a little bit of clarity and information for you, Representative Bliss.
Thank you for that. Other member questions? No? Representative Lucero, or not representative, Commissioner. There's a former Representative Lucero that we all know, now a senator, unfortunately. In the 23-24 budget cycle, you had requested $395,000 to set up a bias registry, I believe. That was the language in the governor's request. I believe that's the same language that went into the final disposition of the bill in its passage. And you had stated that you weren't interested in setting up a bias registry. So if you could give me an update on what that $395,000 was spent on, and then I guess it's an ongoing $250 annually. Just wonder if you could give us an update on that.
Chair Scott, yes, thank you so much for your question. So I believe that you are referencing the legislative report that is required under 363A. That is a live report, and can make sure that that is sent to you if you don't have it already. It is on our website, though. And in our report, we made three key findings. First, we made the finding that civil rights are foundational to Minnesota, and you saw me highlight several of those pieces today. Second, we provided legislators with some information they may benefit from around a comprehensive analysis of the legal ecosystem that exists for bias-motivated crimes. And we talked about what was possible to have better information around when making decisions around bias-motivated crimes. And then the third piece had to do with promoting the safety and well-being of every Minnesotan. It may be beneficial to assess the impact of preventative, responsive, and restorative programs on communities that experience bias-motivated crimes. There's a lot of support that legislators are doing every single day, and understanding how it relates to the to the ecosystem of public safety, I think, is going to be really important. So I think that the agency was actually appropriated about $645,000 this biennium, and I'm going to check that amount for you. Those funds, for the most part, are being returned, and I will follow up with the exact amount, but I think it's about 90% of them.
So Commissioner Lucero, 90% of the funds are being returned?
Chair Scott, what I said is I could follow up with you on the exact numbers, but the funds that were included were are not funds that we will be using.
Okay.
So I believe it's about 90%, but I want to get you the exact number. I think that gets finalized by the end of the
Well, thank you for that. Year. Thank you for that, Commissioner. So are you saying then that the report that you just outlined, that only took about 10% of the money that was allocated to you? Is that kind of what you're saying? Approximately. I know you don't have it right in front of you.
Sure, Scott. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Other member questions? Duran. Representative Duran. Oh.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner, how many complaints do you guys get a year?
Commissioner Lucero.
That's a great question. It actually varies year to year, and it's actually increased pretty substantially. So I'm going to pull up the exact information for you, but all of you have access to a legislative report that we produce two times per year and also lives on our website. So I'm happy to follow up with you to answer all questions around the legislative report. So I'm pulling up the last legislative report right now, and it looks like it was a little bit over 1,000 cases that came in. I'm doing this quickly because there's two reports, but that's about what came in this year. Yeah, maybe about 1,100.
Okay, perfect. Representative Duran?
How many of those were found to be valid, and thank you?
Commissioner?
Well, we don't make determinations on validity. We are doing determinations based on if there's probable cause or not under the Minnesota Human Rights Act to find violations there. And it is also that the information that I think you are probably seeking lives in the legislative reports as well. So, for instance, the case closure data in the most recent legislative report talks about how cases were came to their conclusion. So it says that 40 cases of the 300 cases in that reporting period, 40 were settled through mediation, which is a favorable resolution to both parties. About 53% result in a favorable determination to the respondent. So respondent there, you're going to think of mostly employers, but schools, businesses, etc. So about 53% result in a favorable determination for respondents. And 20% result in a favorable determination for the charging party. There's also 20% that are withdrawn by parties before a determination is reached, maybe because they've decided that they don't want to move forward, that there is not going to be a determination in their favor and they're done, or because they decide they want to file in court.
Representative Bedell? I did it again, didn't I? Duran. And I, Representative Commissioner Lucero, I always have to ask you, because I'm getting older, but because the general population of Minnesota is aging, have you seen any upticks in age discrimination?
Chair Scott, thank you so much for that question. We certainly see cases that are deeply interrelated to age discrimination. So you will have age discrimination cases, but where you see it the most is actually in the disability cases. As we age, our needs for accommodations also increase. And so then a little bit of additional support is necessary there. And so that's where you're gonna see a lot of them there. But yes, we do see age discrimination cases.
Okay, thank you. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Lucero, you almost got me to call a representative. Commissioner Lucero, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate it. You know, one of the things I really appreciated about your presentation is that you laid out that history and where Minnesota has kind of led around anti-discrimination laws and civil rights activity. And it made me think about this moment that we're in now. And my question for you is, you know, considering what's happening at the federal level, mostly through executive orders, in terms of, and it's guised under this DEI, diversity and equity inclusion, which really, to me, it looks like when you peel it back, it's turning us back in terms of where we are now for anti-discrimination laws. Can you talk a bit about how this could possibly impact the work that your office does here in the state of Minnesota?
Commissioner Lucero.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Representative Fraser, thank you. So let's see. I think there's been about 100 executive orders, give or take, in the last couple weeks. So we are working through those to understand how and where and if they impact state law and how they may or may not be aligned with federal statutes and federal case law as well. I think maybe taking a step back, I do want to say that the purpose of the Minnesota Human Rights Act is to prohibit discrimination across the board, and that's in work, in schools, coffee shops, public buses. And as you saw today in Minnesota, we have said for a very long time that every Minnesotan is protected by and benefits from civil rights laws. So as we continue to review these executive orders, we'll figure out what is the next most appropriate steps. But I know that discrimination is not good for this state. It says so directly in statute. I think I'm always worried about how it undermines our ability to really see the dignity and humanity in each of us. And anti-discrimination laws are about how everyone deserves to live a life of dignity and joy free from discrimination. So nothing specific at this point on the executive orders, and Minnesota Human Rights Department continues to do its statutory obligated work every day.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Commissioner Lucero. I think you're spot on when you said that discrimination is not good for this state. In fact, discrimination has not been good for this country. We had a civil war because of it, but thank you.
Representative Feist.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Commissioner Lucero, thank you so much for the important work you do. I just wanted to highlight how supportive I am of the mediation work you do. And it's great to hear, I think you said 40% of your cases resolve in a way that is beneficial for both sides, and that saves costs. And so I'm not at all surprised and very happy to hear that some of your key findings around hate crimes and crimes of bias, restorative interventions and dialogue and bringing people together is often the answer. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Representative Finke. Oh, you're good. Any other comments? All right. Thank you again, Representative Lucero. Get it. Commissioner Lucero. We all wish you the best in the coming days and a safe delivery of that baby, and we'll look forward to hearing more on that. Thank you for joining us today. And with that, we are adjourned.